This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
Today on the podcast, I am actually very excited to have our very first Nobel laureate in the studios. You probably know him from his New York Times columns. He previously to that, he was a writer in Slate, and he now has an extremely popular blog at the New York Times called Conscience of a Liberal. Our guest today is Paul Krugman. I actually was privileged to be the subject of his very first blog post. He referenced something I had written about, and the professor and I have had an email relationship for many years. He's actually pretty good about responding to thoughtful and intelligent comments and questions. We've gone to dinner a number of times with a really interesting cast of people. What you probably don't know about him, nor would you even guess about him, is that he's got a delightfully dry sense of humor. He's very witty, doesn't necessarily come across in some of his more serious Times columns. They're about weighty matters, and it's always something involving economics or politics or something else that we're doing wrong in our society. And so there isn't really a great opportunity for his, I would call it, mischievous sense of humor to show through. But he's really pleasant dinner conversation, pleasant person to just talk about issues. As much as people think he's a difficult person, people have called him hard-edged and mean, and he's really a very logical, very down-to-earth guy in conversations. He's really matter-of-fact. A lot of the people who criticize him really are criticizing how effective he is at demolishing really dumb arguments. If you're on Paul Ryan's staff, you're probably not a big fan of his because he's done more to demolish the Paul Ryan school of political economy than anybody else. And so if he didn't matter, if he wasn't so influential, if he wasn't a major thought leader for the traditional new Keynesian form of progressive economics, I don't think people would be quite so vociferous about him. But he's quite brilliant. He's a pleasure to be around. And I find him just generally to be a great sounding board on these issues. And when Krugman is the correct way to pronounce it, when he takes a stance on a particular issue, it has ramifications throughout the entire political economy, certainly amongst the Democrats who are desperate for some sort of economic leadership, and as well amongst the Republicans. It gives them something to push back on. So with no further ado, let's go to our interview with Nobel laureate Paul Krugman.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
Today, I am thrilled to be sitting with Paul Krugman, a person I know actually for a couple of years. Let me digress and just give a little background for anybody who doesn't know who you are. You graduated Yale in 1974, got your PhD in economics from MIT in 1977, joined the faculty 2 years later, and that same year became a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. In 1982, you went to work for the Reagan White House as a staff member of the Council of Economic Advisors. I think people are surprised when they learn that about you. In 1991, you received the John Bates Clark Medal for economists under the age of 40. Some people have described that as more difficult to win than the Nobel because they only give it every other year. But then you made up for that by winning the Nobel in 2008, the Memorial Prize in Economics. That was your new trade theory, and we may get to that a little later. And somewhere in the middle, you won the Editor and Publisher Columnist of the Year. I believe that was 2002. That's the short version of your CV. Welcome, Paul Krugman.
Hi there.
So we actually first met. I tell the story because it's an amusing story. I had just done an interview for PBS where I quoted you, "He who the gods seek to destroy, they first put on the cover of Business Week." And on the way out of the interview, we literally collided. I sent papers flying. I didn't even know it was you. You were helping me pick up the papers. And I looked up and said, oh, professor, I just quoted you on the air. I don't know if you remember that. It must have been 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think I remember. I've run into a lot of people sending papers flying through the air. So it's okay. Yeah. Anyway.
So that quote is really an interesting place to start. I believe it was in reference to Enron. Is that right?
Oh, I have no idea. But
it's a fabulous quote.
Well, it's yeah. I mean, not many people, you very much included, have made the point. So that was just a way of saying. But yeah, it is this. It's a pretty good indicator if something has become so conventionally, or some person has become so conventionally praised that there are puff pieces on the covers of business magazines, then, oh boy, watch out.
So let's talk about your background, how you became an economist. One of the things I found fascinating about your bio is you first developed an interest in economics because of Isaac Asimov.
That's right. If anybody's read Isaac Asimov, you know that he had the classic Foundation novels.
The trilogy, yeah. which we all read as a kid.
Which is one of the few pieces of science fiction where the heroes are basically social scientists rather than physical scientists. And what they have is they have this mathematical theory of society, psychohistory, which lets them shape the future. And what they do is they save galactic civilization, but through the use of psychohistory. And I said, I want to be one of those guys. And, well, it doesn't quite exist, but economics is as close as you can get in the 21st century.
Have you ever bumped into another economist who cites any science fiction writer as an influence?
Yeah, it's actually reasonably common. Not as much as you might think, actually. I was surprised there aren't more, but there's a fair number of science fiction fans in the profession, and for some reason, even more among the political scientists. I don't know. I don't know quite why that is. But anyway, yeah, I'm not alone.
So that's pretty interesting. So let's go back to, aside from Asimov, who are your big influences in the fields of either economics or politics or both?
Well, economics, I had really great mentors and role models. I'd say Bill Nordhaus at Yale was my original mentor. I worked with him on a piece on energy futures back in 1973, which was a great learning experience. I was still an undergrad at that point. At MIT, vastly in awe of Bob Solow, who the Nobel laureate and great economist. But what I really admired about him was his intellectual and literary style. He was the master of the simplified, insightful model, and the article that expounds that model written with a lot of panache and style. And so I tried to, model myself on him as best I could. And Rudy Dornbusch, who unfortunately died quite young, but he was the international economist, tremendous influence on a lot of people. And I was Rudy's, I very much worked with him, learned how to do economics, learned how to play a role as an economist from Rudy.
Is it fair to say that Solow was the person who set the model for your New York Times column?
I think at some level, yes, although he was never writing much by way of journalism. But this business of figure out exactly what it is you need to say, come up with the simplest possible analysis that says it, and then try to write it in a way that actually is entertaining and interesting. That's what I learned from Solow, and he's been, it's the whole style, the whole intellectual style that was lots of people modeled themselves on him. He's a great man, but for me, sure, I think part of that style, what we think of as the Solow style or the MIT style, is something you can do for academic work, but then it pretty easily carries over into being a journalist too.
So if we're talking about influences, I think somewhere along the line, we have to mention both Milton Friedman and John Maynard Keynes. How did their work affect you beyond merely being building blocks of the profession?
Well, Keynes is the model for, there's one of the pieces of the great Skidelsky biography is titled The Economist as Savior. So Keynes is showing how understanding can be a powerful force in the world and explaining. And of course, Keynes had his own style, which is more Rococo and from an earlier era, but also there was a lot to be learned from that. Friedman, he was a great economist. Don't agree with him about everything, but also someone who understood the power of exposition as well as the power of analysis.
We're speaking with Nobel laureate and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. We continue our conversation on income inequality and the two societies in America.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This is Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. I'm Barry Ritholtz. I'm thrilled to be speaking with Professor Paul Krugman, still at Princeton, but soon to be coming to CUNY, where you are going to be focusing on the Luxembourg Institute of Economic Inequality. Am I getting that correct?
The Luxembourg Income Study, but anyway, yes.
And so you have been discussing economic inequality for a long time. I'm trying to remember the book you wrote.
Age of Diminished Expectations.
Early 1989.
90s?
Okay, 89. And that was way ahead of the curve, identifying economic inequality as a potentially damaging trend. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was already obvious by the late 1980s that something was happening. It was clear already in the statistics that something big had happened, that there was that long post-war, equal growth, everybody sharing in it was not happening anymore. And it was actually already clear. If you go back to the book, I was talking a fair bit about the 1%, because it was already clear that it wasn't just the top 20%, that there was a real huge surge at the top 1%.
But that's so, passé now. The top 1%,
well,
you and I are in the top 1%.
Yeah.
Anybody can be in the top 1% these days.
Right.
It's the top 1% of the 1% where the real money seems to, the outlandish money is being made.
That's right. We suspected that even then, but sure, now it's really clear. And yeah, and what we thought was incredible inequality in 1989, it was nothing. I mean, Gordon Gekko would be a poor man by the standards of today's rich. So sure, but it seemed obvious to me that this was a really big issue right from the beginning.
So aside from the fairness issue, what's wrong with economic inequality? I heard somebody who I disagreed this morning make a description that, listen, if we give everybody the same amount, that's not fair. But that's not really what we're talking about. What we're talking about is when inequality reaches just outrageous extremes.
Yeah, I think we're talking, first of all, about there's been enough redistribution, if you like, the shift, the growing share of the pie accruing to the 1% and the 0.1% and all of that is big enough so that ordinary families have been disconnected from economic growth. Real wages of the typical worker have basically been flat for several decades, even though productivity is way up. You ask, well, where did the productivity go? And the answer was it went to the 1%. So just in raw numerical terms, it's a big deal. It's enough to give you decades of this disconnect between the economy and the fate of workers. And then this question is, I think, basically, it's not even so much abstract notions of fairness as the shape of the society. Mm-hmm. A society where you have a very, very large share of income and even larger share of wealth in the hands of a few people, and in which power, influence is at least partially driven by money, not by votes. That's a society that is not really what we envision America as being. So, certainly I don't want us to be Cuba. We're not talking about everybody having an equal share. The question is, I thought American society as it was when I was growing up was a reasonable level of inequality. It was certainly not an egalitarian society, but America as it is now, and worse yet, America as it seems likely to be in another 10 or 20 years on current track, that's starting to become something that is alarmingly unequal, something that is not at all in line with our vision of who we are supposed to be as a country.
So we went from one man, one vote to $1, one vote, and that seems to be a pretty significant political shift.
Yeah, not that it has happened before, right?
We're back to levels last seen in 1928, 29.
Yeah, we're back essentially. 20s. Yeah, we're back to the Gilded Age. Back when McKinley beat, William Jennings Bryan, the big Republican political boss of the time said there are two things that matter in politics. One of them is money, and I can't remember what the other one was. it's not that these things haven't happened before, but we had congratulated ourselves on not being that kind of a country anymore, and now we're that kind of a country again, and we don't want to be there.
We're speaking with New York Times columnist and Nobel laureate Paul Krugman about income inequality. You'd had a huge review in the New York Review of Books, or was it the Sunday Times?
New York Review of Books.
On Piketty's Capitalism in the 21st Century.
Yes.
And he makes some pretty strong arguments that economic inequality has pernicious and lasting negative effects on whatever society it reaches an extreme in. And you were pretty supportive of that. You want to explain that in simple terms for the audience?
Yeah, I think the way you want to think about this is that a lot of it runs through politics, that you end up – any sustained period of extreme inequality ends up being one where the inequality is largely driven not by talent but by assets. That's actually the –
And we've seen the financialization of the U.S. economy over the past half century – huge stock options, which created a whole swath of wealth, and a lot of tax cuts over the past 30 years.
Yeah.
Have those things contributed?
Yes, of course. And there's a kind of a spiral here where the richer the rich get, the more political influence they have, the more the tax code starts to favor the further accumulation, and they start to become, and we don't like to even discuss this, but it starts to become an increasingly inherited status.
Look at all the Walton billionaires.
That's right. If you look at the top 10, according to Forbes, you've got four Waltons and two Cokes. There are three self-made men in there. Then if you look further down the list, you see an awful lot of 80-year-old billionaires,
right,
who will soon be replaced by not 80-year-old heirs of billionaires. So this leads to something that I think most Americans would consider to be a bad form of society. We want people to succeed on their merits. Also, a society where with restricted opportunity, and this becomes once you have that much sort of entrenched wealth, it becomes a society with limited opportunity, which means that there's a huge waste of human potential. People who weren't born to the right parents never get to make the contribution to society that they ought to. So this is a bad thing.
So we have a minute left in the segment. Let's talk about the carried interest loophole. There's 1,000 or 2,000 people who qualify for this. They end up paying 15% income tax on they work in a private equity fund or a hedge fund. How has this not been overturned? As Warren Buffett says, why is his secretary paying so much more taxes as a percentage than he pays?
Well, money talks. Money talks and money votes, in effect, and it
even
does
so. There's 1,000 managers who get to take advantage of this in
about
a country of 300 plus million.
Think about how close we came to eliminating the estate tax, even though at this point only a handful of gigantic estates actually pay it.
Right.
The influence, the pull of money, and it's not just – some of it is crude corruption. Some of it is – campaign contributions. Some of it is just the indirect people. You know, these are people who get to hire people who get to shape the discourse. And it is this is one of the things you learn from Piketty. He shows you that if you go back to 19th century France, which was an egalitarian, liberté, égalité, fraternité, the ideology, the official ideology, was very much about equal rights for all Frenchmen. The reality was dominance by a hereditary aristocracy.
We're speaking with Nobel laureate and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. We continue our conversation about what it was like the day he found out he won the Nobel Prize.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Today we're speaking with Nobel laureate Paul Krugman. So one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was a day in the life of Paul Krugman, but more specifically, you've described winning the Nobel Prize as surreal, which is a word that other Nobel Prize winners have used. What was that day like?
Oh, the day of, first of all, I got a call. I wasn't at home.
You were in the shower.
I was in the shower. I was in Washington, D.C. for a conference. I was in the shower, 6:30 a.m. My cell phone rings, and somebody is on the other end with an obviously fake Swedish accent. clearly, it's a hoax. And they're supposed to have somebody who knows you do the call, but they didn't manage to arrange that.
You've been on that short list for a long time, and you kind of thought, I've become too politically hot potato. I got the sense that
it had
you
been,
had written off.
It had been raised as a possibility. Who knows what? But I'd actually made a very deliberate. Let's not think about this.
Right.
Don't think. I know people who are waiting for that call each year, and it eats you alive.
That's got to be miserable, right?
Yeah, so the hell with it.
It's all about expectations, and if you have reasonable expectations, you're not going to be disappointed.
That's right, and you know, just don't go there. And so I got the call, and I didn't know whether it was for real. I wasn't able to check it on the website until half an hour later. I called my wife to say, I don't know whether this was for real or not, but if it was, and her reaction was, oh, my God, brief pause. We don't have time for this because we have a textbook that we've written together.
Who has time for them?
Right.
And then really?
It takes over your life when you go to Sweden. It's a week of, it sounds like, oh, this is great, you're being celebrated, but you're actually being worked like a dog.
Right.
And so, my wife had a lot of good things to say. She said, you know, there's two great things. One is that you won this. The other is that we'll never have to go through this again.
That's actually not true because there have been a couple of multiple.
True. Joe Stiglitz, who was at me with
one was solo, one was with someone else of Stiglitz, or were they both with somebody else?
No, one was Stiglitz sharing it with several other people for path-breaking work on information and economics, and one was as a member of the panel that produces the climate change reports. So he's part of, so he's got one in, essentially, he's got one in economics and one in peace.
That's fantastic.
But but anyway.
So just avoid those sort of panels and you'll be safe.
I think it's safe. And I don't think I'm going to get one for literature or any of that stuff. So no, but it was, you know, it's you are for a week, you are the center of all attention and everything's happening. And all of a sudden, actually, everybody wants to contact you. I thought I had a private cell phone number. It turns out that thousands of people have it. So the whole thing was you know, it's a very... It's funny because at one level, who cares what some Swedes think? You know, the serious professional colleagues either thought my work was great and still think it's great, or didn't think my work was that great and still don't think it was
that
great.
It's not going to
change their mind. But it's a brand that everybody else understands. And so all of a sudden it puts you in a different category.
It's funny. We have a conference every October and, you know, I don't really pay attention to when these things come out. And I had sent an invite to Bob Schiller. And he's usually pretty good about getting back to me. And I had sent the invite, and the next day, the Nobels came out, and he won. And I'm not going to hear from him for a while. And about 2 weeks later, one of his staff wrote me back and said, you're the only person who tagged Bob before the award. Let's circle back about this when things calm down. It must be absolute mayhem for a month.
Yeah, and then, you know, for about 2 weeks— maybe 3 weeks, people don't say you're stupid and you don't understand economics. And then by a month later, everything is right back to the way it was, except that your speaking fees go up and you get invited to a lot of very fancy things that you probably don't want to go to. But no, look, I'm being too cynical. It's great. It's a ticket for entry into things. It helps you. You still have to do good stuff, but you get more opportunities because you have that credential.
You know, I had done Larry Kudlow's show some years ago, and I remember blowing into the green room, and there's this NYU prof there, and hi, what are you here for? And I always get wired before you go on the air. Hi, I'm talking about a research piece I just did. It's on volatility and blah, blah, blah. And he says, I study volatility. I'm a professor at NYU. And, you know, what do you find? Well, we find volatility gets away in of trading and this and that. And I'm just thinking, egghead professor, look, we like volatility spikes because that tells us there's a lot of fear and that usually is a good entry, blah, blah, blah. So I go out, I do my shtick on Kudlow. And at the end of the segment, he says, and I'm thrilled to bring my next guest up, Professor Bob Engel of NYU, the winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics this year for his study on volatility. And I turn purple. And speaking to him afterwards, I start apologizing. And he's like, oh, please, you're the only person in 2 weeks who's spoken to me like a real person. It was a pleasure to just actually have a conversation with someone's not fawning all over me.
Yeah. It's you know, if you spend your life living as, look at me, big Nobel laureate, that's a terrible thing. There's no way to live.
We're speaking with New York Times columnist, Princeton economics professor, and now City University professor, Paul Krugman. We continue our conversation about the challenges of traditional economics and what the economics profession gets wrong.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. I'm Barry Ritholtz. Today we're speaking with Paul Krugman, New York Times columnist, Princeton economics professor, Bates Medal Award winner, and most recently, winner of the Nobel Prize in economics. I want to discuss in this segment the challenges of traditional economics. When we look at the crisis of 08-09, most of the economic profession missed it. The exception, Reinhardt and Rogoff had a brilliant paper, I want to say December 07, that effectively said we're in a credit bubble and we should expect a 50% cut in equity prices, a 30% drop in real estate, and I think people looked a bit askance at that paper. Why was the profession more or less blindsided by this?
Oh, I think it's interesting. I don't think there was a fundamental flaw in the way we do economics. Actually, I think we had the necessary intellectual tools to make sense of this.
Mm-hmm.
What we didn't have was sufficient knowledge of the world, and we didn't have sufficient courage of our convictions. So, what Reinhardt and Rogoff were doing was looking at history, which is of tremendously useful guide and has turned out to be an excellent guide. If you understood what happened in the 30s, or for that matter, if you were following Japan in the 90s, you got an awful lot of the last 5 years right. But people didn't make that connection. They didn't want to see it. But also there were you have to get past the superficial. So people said, well, we can't have bank runs like in the 30s because bank deposits are insured. But a bank is not necessarily a big marble building with rows of tellers. A bank is anything that borrows short and lends long, that provides liquidity. And so it turns out that repo is for all practical purposes like banking, and a run on repo may not look visually It's a Wonderful Life, but it is a bank run for all economic purposes. And people didn't see that. They didn't understand that we developed shadow banking and all of that. So that's a failure to pay enough attention to the world. So you had the framework. As soon as you understood that repo was just like a bank run, then you understood what had happened. You could slot that right into your framework, but people didn't do that in advance. And then I've seen so many of my colleagues in economics just when their analysis clearly says that what the serious, responsible people are saying is all wrong, they choke. They don't have the courage of being willing to say it. So when all the serious people are saying, oh, look at the size of those deficits, interest rates will have to spike, and you want to say, look, we have a pretty good model of zero lower bound, interest rates up against zero, which says that ain't going to happen under these conditions.
Here's Japan for 30 years.
That's right.
Where's the interest rate?
But
huge deficits, and yet their rates are even lower than ours.
That's right. But people were not enough people were willing to say, okay, look, yes, there are all these guys in finance, but they've never experienced something like this. And you have to study history, you have to study models to understand this. And we've done that. And what they're saying is wrong. Not a whole lot of people were willing to say that. So
that's a theme, by the way, in your work, and we saw it with the Bush tax cuts, the Iraq War. You were one of the few voices that were out there speaking truth that the powers that be didn't want to hear. You know, the old joke is you don't need to speak to truth to power. They know what the truth is. You need to speak truth to the public. They need to figure it out. And the powers that be are what's trying to block that. You mentioned with Reinhardt and Rogoff the advantage of looking back at history and saying, here's what we know works, here's what we know doesn't work. We come out of this 08-09 collapse where clearly there were lots of warning signs. People missed them. And then suddenly the same folks who were wrong about the crisis now are saying we really need to radically cut these deficits in order to stimulate the economy. We have to get the deficit confidence fairy excited, and that will bring us to economic nirvana. And we watched Europe essentially take a bad situation, make it much worse. We've done a little bit of the same thing here.
Yeah, a fair bit, actually.
Why haven't we learned from history?
Well, I think that's That is an interesting question, and it's a combination. Part of it is, in fact, vested interests. If you think a lot of what's gone wrong in policy right now makes sense, if you think that of policymakers as basically being on the side of creditors rather than on the side of the economy, You know,
right. So bondholders were made completely 100 cents on the dollar.
Yeah. Deflationary policies are good for bondholders, bad for debtors. Extreme concern, excessive concern about budget deficits is something that would happen if you really care about the bondholders and really are pretty much indifferent to the consequences for jobs. So that's one thing. But it's not. It's also, I think that there are the kind of economic crisis we've been in, and we're still in it, is one which is very uncomfortable for a lot of people because it is one in which the usual rules don't apply, in which budget deficits can actually be helpful, in which responsible policies, seemingly responsible policies, can actually be destructive and so on. As I said, where prudence is folly and virtue is vice. And that makes people uncomfortable, and they keep on wanting to revert to the old stuff. They want to warn against inflation even though there's no inflation. They want to...
Hyperinflation. It's coming any day now. We've been hearing that how many years? Yeah. Was it the letter that was signed by...
Oh, that was, the 2010 letter of the debasing of the dollar. Sure. But I think that the urge to sound serious ends up trumping the desire to actually be serious. And that's been a big factor that has made it very hard for us to deal with the realities of this situation.
We're speaking with Paul Krugman about the follies and tribulations of practicing modern economics. Let's twist this a little bit. So we earlier mentioned Shiller, one for his work on behavioral economics. Is that the future of – is behavioral economics, neurofinance, and a study of – cognitive biases, is that the future of economics, or is that just going to be an increasingly important branch?
I think it's not going to completely take over, even though I'm very much a believer in the importance of looking at how people actually decide. The trouble with behavioral economics is that it's, inherently by the nature of it, it doesn't give you any big unified theory. It gives you lots of interesting observations, lots of things that help you make sense of particular situations. But I think the idealized model with Homo economicus is never going to go away. That is still going to always be a baseline that you use to compare things to. And so I think it's going to be a long time before we stop teaching supply and demand and maximization and all that. But we're going to need to make a lot of room for this other stuff, which is about how people actually behave, especially in complicated situations. So I think eclectic rather than a complete takeover is the way you want to go.
And what about Shiller's co-winner was Eugene Fama for some of his work on efficient market hypothesis and dissemination of information. But as we've seen, and as Shiller has argued, we have bubbles, booms, and busts. How efficient can the market really be if the NASDAQ is at 5,000 in the year 2000 and then collapses 80% over the next 2 years?
Yeah. When Fama and Shiller got the prize together, and then Hansen, who's a statistical methodologist. But one reaction was, the Riksbank committee has got a sense of humor. The thing is, I think there is a value in work like Fama's, again, to set a benchmark, kind of baseline. Right. The trouble is, as I understand it, Fama doesn't see it that way. He sees it as being the truth. So Shiller will have positive things to say about Fama, but not vice versa. And that's unfortunate.
But that's also because Shiller is just a delightful gentleman. I mean, you can't picture him saying a cross word about anybody.
True. He's a really nice guy. And also, I mean, he's not just a great thinker, a great researcher, but sometimes his ability to just my favorite paper of his, even though it wasn't the most important, was he in the 87 stock market crash. He had a lot of people's fax numbers. And so he did an instant survey as the market was crashing to ask, why are you selling? And once you had that, it turned out that it made nonsense of all the rationalizations people were offering because nobody mentioned any of the things that people were saying, oh, the government did this or the Germans did that. Instead, it was, well, I'm selling because prices are falling. It was wonderful. It's just, yes, okay, here's somebody who's trumped all of that, you know, that fancy appearance of knowledge with, here's what the actual fact was.
Hey, the market's collapsing. I don't want to get caught with it falling and look like an idiot. I got to get out.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where the behavioral economics is so strong because you realize people simply aren't rational. And I give them credit for at least admitting that, hey, prices are going down, I got to get out. It's always hilarious when that happens.
Yeah, and I think the great thing about Schiller, and the great thing about the Schiller Prize is that it legitimizes, not everything has to be rigorously derived from first principles, because in fact, people aren't rigorously derived from first principles. They behave in ways that are sometimes irrational, and understanding, at least historically, how they behaved is a much better guide to reality than sticking to your theorems.
Thank you to Paul Krugman for spending so much time with us today on the show. Paul is New York Times columnist, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, professor at Princeton University, and now City University. By the way, if you enjoy these conversations, be sure and check out our podcast extras. You can find them on either Bloomberg.com or, finally, on Apple iTunes. My daily column shows up at BloombergView.com. Be sure to follow me on Twitter, @Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. This concludes the broadcast portion of our interview. Coming up with our guest, the Radio Podcast Extra. Let's talk about we talked about some of the failures and some of the stars of the old generation. Let's talk about the next generation of economists. So who are the up-and-coming rock stars? Anybody stand out that you're impressed with?
I mean, I've been seeing a lot of work I like, and I have a maybe too localized view. So I'm
Tri-state? Is that this area?
Well, not localized. Localized in intellectual space.
Okay.
I'm really interested in all of these issues surrounding the ongoing economic slump. And what I'm seeing is a lot of really very wonderful, I would say, work using new approaches to history, to data, to cast light on it. So, I'd mention Gudi Egertsen at Brown, who I've written a paper with, but is doing fabulous work on his own and with other people. Really, he's been on this subject for about 10 years, mm-hmm, before it ever happened. I'd mention Emi Nakamura and John Steinson are doing this extremely clever work on fiscal policy, exploiting things like variations in defense spending across states to get an estimate of how potent are these changes in government spending. Mian and Sufi with their work on debt. But I'm not sure which of these is going to really take off. We're not, I think, at this point in the era at the moment of the theoretical breakthrough that changes everything, in part because in basic terms, our theory is not working so badly. We're in the age of people who have where the best work comes from finding those natural experiments by cleverly making use of history and the available data that give us a sense of what are the quantitative sides of this thing really like, what really matters.
Well, which leads us to, we mentioned earlier, the MIT Billion Prices Project. The hyperinflationists, the gold bugs, a number of people are fond of pointing out how completely corrupted and biased CPI data is. And my answer to these folks are always, well, what about the Billion Prices Project? And they always kind of shrug it off.
I'm a big consumer of it. And these are, it's MIT, it's Roberto Rigobon, who I know from way back. And it's a very, very clever thing.
Explain a little bit.
So the Billion Prices Project is they have an algorithm that essentially trawls through to find the prices of things sold on the internet. And it lets them do a real-time price index based on stuff that's being sold on the internet.
It's not biased. It's not influenced by politics, as people have criticized. Not that I think CPI is, but okay, if you think CPI is so off, how do you rationalize all these prices that are fairly flat?
That's right. What the Billion Prices Project has done is it's provided an independent source of information that is completely different in methodology and completely different in people from the official price indices. And the fact that it looks about the same is telling you, in one level, you could say, well, since it looks about the same as the CPI, do we need it? But on the other hand, since people are raising all of these, I think actually quite vile accusations against the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But the
who, by the way, if you ever call them up, you can get an economist or a staff person. They're enormously helpful. I had, back in the day, I had questions about owner's equivalent rent and what that was doing to CPI when, perversely, when home prices were skyrocketing and rentals were plummeting, it had this bizarre impact of reducing. In the mid-2000s, when we had genuine inflation, it actually had a negative impact on the data. And they make no bones about it. Yeah, this is what OER does. It's this much of a drag. Like, they don't hide anything. It's all out there.
And in fact, it's an interesting thing because government statistics are terribly valued, terribly important. And so you get the people who do it are an important resource. And they don't get a lot of love. They don't get a lot of attention. So they're actually often quite eager to be helpful if you actually show some interest in what they do. And I see this the other day. Joe Scarborough goes on about, census is changing the questionnaire it uses to measure whether health insurance data, and which they're doing for very good reasons.
But the health insurance has changed. Why wouldn't we change that?
And they also thought that the previous version was actually had some serious flaws that were well known. So he said, obviously, it's they're cooking the books to favor Obamacare. And it's like, my God, how dare you? Right? You don't understand a thing. You don't know a thing about this. Here are these really hardworking civil servants, not very well paid, doing their damnedest to make sense of a very ever-changing economy.
Right.
And you just casually accuse them of being corrupt.
It's a costless accusation. And you get to look a little smarter because you haven't been, you haven't been blindsided by this obviously corrupt. I'm fond of quoting George Box, who said, all models are wrong, but some are useful. And if the data series is more or less consistent over time, it doesn't have to be accurate as long as it's fairly precise. Yeah. Hey, is unemployment going up? Is unemployment going down? Are we creating jobs? Are we losing jobs? You don't need to know to the person how many jobs were created last month. What's the overall trend? Is it going in the right direction or the wrong direction?
I fairly often get asked, what's the true measure of unemployment? The answer is, there's no true measure of unemployment. There are various indicators we use. U3, which is the one everyone quotes, is a pretty good measure, but obviously makes errors in both directions. U6, which is the broader measure, those are both interesting, and they're not.
They track each other.
Usually
they
tell the same story,
together.
And when they don't tell the same story, that in turn is interesting. You want to ask what's going on that's making those diverse.
Why are we seeing these go in different directions?
So it's a huge thing. Measurement is we don't give enough honor to the people who give us the grist for our thinking, and those government statistics are a very big part of it. And the Billion Prices Project is great because it is a relatively cheap, low budget way to provide a check. I mean, it's good to have it. And if some future corrupt Bureau of Labor Statistics commissioner, hard to imagine, but anyway, should in fact want to cook the book, we would have alternative measures that would flash a warning signal.
And I think as time goes by and more things move to the web, there are going to be lots and lots of alternatives. I love the Fred app from
If listeners don't know this, Fred, Federal Reserve Economic Data, which is run out of the St. Louis Fed, all of that data.
That's on my iPhone. That's an app. If you wanted to have access to this 20 years ago, you would need a staff of 10 economists.
I was in Washington,
82, 83,
I had an HP calculator, hand calculator, and stacks of books. And I would copy down numbers from the books and punch them into the calculator to do the, or you'd have to get somebody to put them onto punch cards. I grew up in the age when you fed computers punch cards and you also killed your dinner with a stone axe. But anyway, it produces quick access to tons of stuff, and they keep expanding it. So now we've got international data.
It's astonishing.
Yeah.
It's an unbelievably rich access to data that was unthinkable a couple of decades ago. I'm not talking a century ago when there were leather belts moving steam-propelled stuff through a factory. I'm talking when I was in grad school, you didn't have in the late 80s, you didn't have access to this sort of stuff.
Well, like I said, when I was in grad school, it was punch cards. So my senior thesis was my PhD thesis was a big box full of punch cards. So
we mentioned earlier a little bit about Friedman, a little bit about Keynes. What do people get wrong about Keynes? What do people not understand about him?
Wow, there's levels and levels. So the crudest, most primitive thing is either believing that Keynes was some kind of left-wing socialist, which he very much was not. He was there to save capitalism, not to bring it down.
Right.
Or believing that he was somehow, because he was worried about the business cycle, depressions, that he was somehow an opponent of long-run thinking. So, you know, everybody's favorite Keynes quote,
sure,
in the long run, we are all dead. People don't understand what he was saying there. He was not saying, I don't care about the long run. He was saying that economists, the actual thing is that economists set themselves too easy, too useless a task if they can tell us only that when the storm is long past, the sea is flat. I think we've got that more or less right.
Right.
That we do need to understand that if you just tell me, okay, in the long run, the effects of the financial crisis of 2008 will fade away. Well, you know, great, but what about the next 5 years? That's important too. What you find is that critics of Keynes, by and large, they try to critique him on some as if he were just spouting opinion or as if he were just trying to advance some political agenda, when in fact he had a very deep world-changing analysis. If you've read Keynes and really read, not just looked for some things to hate, you come out seeing the world with different eyes.
For
all
sure.
all of a sudden you realize that things are not, you know, supply and demand is great in its place, but sometimes it's just the wrong way to think about things. And sometimes there really can be just not enough demand. And sometimes things that sound like they should be a waste can actually be better than not. So the famous passage, or I tried to, about where, you know, where he talked about let's fill coal mines with bottles of cash. He wasn't actually proposing that, but it was a thought experiment to make you understand that if the problem with the economy is there just isn't enough spending to employ people, then even seemingly pointless ways of pumping money into the economy can be positive.
And I think what so many people get wrong is, you know, you mentioned earlier the business cycle. He's not just a deficit spend public works program sort of guy. On the other half of the cycle, he says, hey, when the economy is doing well, that's when you lower government spending and raise taxes. People completely ignore that.
He said, the boom, not the slump, is the time for austerity.
That's right.
That's not an anti-austerity position. That's a timing position. You know,
That's exactly right. And I think so many people have willfully chosen to ignore it because it doesn't allow them to pigeonhole him as a crazy leftist socialist. Instead, he's a guy. The problem with it is that politicians aren't willing to do it. It's not that his theory is wrong. It's that good luck getting any politician to say, okay, now's the time to cut spending and raise taxes so we could balance the budget, other than maybe Bill Clinton kind of did that, or
except
at least
the
moved
funny,
during it.
The funny thing is that it actually – you need to be a little bit careful about – my read of the lessons of history is that it's much – that the people often say, oh, gosh, you know, you try to do stimulus in a slump and then it never goes away. That's not what history actually tells us. What history has told us is that when you try to do stimulus in a slump, almost always what happens is the stimulus gets withdrawn too soon, not too late.
1938 is a good example.
Now, Europe, the United States, in the Great Recession. It turns out that the nagging from the deficit scolds does a lot more harm than the tendency of government programs to get locked in. I can't even think of a case where stimulus programs, it must be somewhere, but I can't think of a case, certainly in advanced countries, where programs introduced to boost the economy during a slump failed to go away when the economy recovered. Much more common that they get yanked out when the economy is nowhere near having recovered.
I'll tell you my pet peeve on that, my personal pet peeve, is under Eisenhower, we expanded the national highway system, which not only was a great stimulus program, but it was a multiplier. It's existed for decades. It created a lot of wealth. And the maintenance is paid for by an 18.2 cents, if I'm remembering that correctly, gasoline tax, which has not gone up since 1992 or 93, and it's not adjusted for inflation. Yeah. So effectively, we've given up on maintaining our highways, roads, and bridges. I don't understand that thought process.
Well, I do think I understand it, but it is an amazing thing. Sure, we've
envy of the world at one point in time, our highway system.
We've spent the last 5 years in a depressed economy. So essentially, from a social point of view, labor is free. We have all these unemployed construction workers. Capital is free because we have zero interest rates. You have all this savings with no place to go. So what do? We cut back on infrastructure spending. That's insane, right? We could be building things that would last us, that would make us a richer country for decades to come at zero cost.
Right. Cheap borrowing costs, labor available, willing to work. How much should have the original Obama stimulus have been?
Well, at peak, it should have been twice as big as it was, and it should have gone on longer. Well, no.
Or you're talking about the almost $800 billion?
Right. The stimulus itself was around $800 billion. The maximum at an annual rate was less than half that, 2.5% of GDP. It should have peaked at 5% of GDP, and it should have gone on longer. So it really should have been at least three times as big. And, you know, if you think about think about the balance of risks. If you make the stimulus too big, okay, then you end up having to borrow some more money, and you probably have to raise interest rates a little bit if the economy is ready to overheat.
Right.
But if you make it too small, then you're risking, as we know, you're risking a kind of Japanese-style permanent slump. You're also risking turning large numbers of workers into the permanently unemployed, because
long-term,
once you've been unemployed
more than
6 months, nobody wants to look at you. So nobody could know exactly how big the stimulus should be, but we should have been very willing to err on the side of making it too big. And of course, what we did was the opposite. We made it too small. And then, having done something that was obviously too small, the political process turned around and said, oh, look, it didn't solve the economy. So clearly it doesn't work. So let's not do any more of that.
So how much of this is political? Because I look at the people who are against stimulus, who are against infrastructure projects, as the same folks who are, hey, there's a surplus, we really should be cutting taxes. Oh, and besides, deficits don't matter. They suddenly change the deficit scolds are really deficit peacocks, because they're really only pretending when they're out of power. And once they're in power, they're the biggest deficit spenders there are.
Yeah. Part of it is that a lot of the real debate is or the real fight, the debate is not honest at all. The fight is in large part about the size of government. And so there are people who say, I'm against deficits, but you propose a tax increase to reduce the deficit or propose not doing a tax cut. And, they're not interested in that. They're only interested in cutting government spending, and particularly government spending on poor people. So there's certainly that. It's a big political thing. But I think it's also the case that just a lot of people, the deficits did get very big in the slump. And you should have been able to say, well, wait, there's a reason for that. In fact, thank God for those deficits. If we had tried to balance the budget, we would have had Great Depression 2.0.
Right.
But not many people had the courage of their convictions, and they were willing to get on this bandwagon of this great pivot that took place in 2010, where despite cripplingly high unemployment, all of a sudden, all we were talking about was deficits instead. And that was a very bad thing.
That's a theme you keep coming back to, which is a number of people just lacking the cojones to step up and say, here's what reality is. Let's stop pussyfooting around. We need to face this up and acknowledge it and respond to it.
Yeah, I think I think, by the way, this is the flaw in Keynes. Not that there's anything wrong with his intellectual framework, which most of which has stood up very well, but the political framework, the political ability to change direction when the economy really, really needs it, turns out to be much less than I think he imagined. But it's very hard for it turns out that a really severe economic shock, which puts you into a kind of a different universe where the rules are different, that overwhelms the ability of our opinion-making elite to deal with it, to process it. They just revert, most of them, to conventional stuff. I don't know if people remember, I actually was one of the few people who was quite negative about Obama's inauguration speech. And the reason was it was full of, we need to make hard choices, we need to make tough decisions, and that's what we need to be doing right now, which was, that's Washington boilerplate, and it was exactly wrong for the state of the U.S. economy in early 2009, when what we needed to do above all was not make hard choices. We need to go out there and spend. But very, very difficult for people to make that change of direction when the situation warrants it.
So let's talk a little bit about, I have down, you've changed the dynamics of the economic conversation, the popular economic and political conversation, through the New York Times twice a week column. I recall when you were writing for Slate.
Yeah.
And then you moved to the Times.
Well, first column in January of 2000.
Okay. And you 2 years later, you win the award from the Editor and Publishers Association.
Yeah. That was the era of the Bush tax cuts. And it was one of those things where saying the obvious was a radical thing.
Which is kind of hard to imagine, but...
But it has been true a lot over my tenure at the Times. And sure, I was just... I had the impression that... Well, look, what I was doing, I think it's much easier... Not quite the right word for this, sorry. There are... At the time, there were very few people writing on economics who were familiar with how to read CBO reports. We're familiar mm-hmm. with the arithmetic of budgets or the simple textbook economic models. So just by bringing that kind of numeracy onto the op-ed page of the Times, I was opening up the debate in the way that it needed to be opened up. Now at this point, the Times itself has multiple people doing really good stuff on along those lines. So the Times itself is a powerhouse of such analysis. I hope I can keep a little bit ahead of the curve.
When you started, who else was writing? Bill Sapphire was no longer...
Sapphire was still there.
Was he doing columns or just doing on language?
No, I think he was doing columns still.
Who else was on the editorial pages that you recall?
Well, Tom Friedman.
Right. Your doppelganger.
Yeah. we can tell that story in a bit. But yeah, I'm trying to remember now.
When did David Brooks join the paper?
It was a few years later, years later, actually.
So here you're a guy from an academic background, an economist, obviously a self-professed wonk, now on a platform that's read by a fairly educated, sophisticated audience, but mainstream and civilian, not of the academic persuasion of economics. How do you change your focus or do you change your focus?
Well, yeah. No, you do, but I actually had a long apprenticeship. I started writing columns for
I remember the Slate series.
Well,
right,
and even
before that,
I actually wrote for US News and World Report in the late 1980s, which was I never found anybody who actually read it, but there I was writing. So I first started writing columns. I think I wrote some for the LA Times way, way back, and that was terrible. Actually, it is a learned craft.
10,000 hours later, it only takes a decade to be an overnight sensation.
That's right. That's
by the late 90s, you're pretty good. By the way, you're being a little humble. Your Slate columns were very good.
Yeah, I wrote for Fortune also, and that was. But there's a, but there is a craft to it. You need to imagine. Put yourself in the head of your reader. What does he or she know? What doesn't he or she know? How can I explain that in simple terms? You also have to bear in mind that you're to some extent in the entertainment business. Nobody has to sit through if the payoff doesn't come until eight paragraphs into the column. Nobody's going to buy it.
But by the way, you horrified me with your. We were discussing your Times columns at some dinner one. And I think I had just started the Washington Post column, And I felt like I wanted to put a little more time into what I had for it. And I asked you, how much time do you spend on each Times column? And I think you said something, well, 4 or 5 drafts, 10 hours. And I fell out of my chair. I'm like, wait, I'm doing this in a half hour. I need to put another 9 hours into this. You're killing me. You really spend a lot of time and effort given that platform to make sure that's a well-crafted, persuasive piece of writing.
I'm not sure I spend that much time on the columns.
Well, you've gotten
now.
Better, so it's a little quicker.
But no, look, it's a responsibility, right?
This
is the most valuable journalistic real estate in the world.
I would say that's a fair statement.
The op-ed page in the New York Times is you are there in the world's leading newspaper, in the most prominent page except for page one. You've been given this enormous privilege. It's respect for the readers, if nothing else.
For sure.
Requires that you give it your best effort. And also the fact that at least the things I want to talk about are generally, they're pretty big topics, pretty complex if you wanted to get into all the details. So finding a way to get that across in 800 words and to do it well without either losing the reader or without skipping something important.
And you never dumb it down. You talk to the readers like they're adults.
Yeah. So that's work. That's not, I almost always am pretty sure about what I want to say, mm-hmm. but it often will take me a lot of, I don't actually do separate drafts. I do a continuous rolling redraft, but it will often take me a number of hours to boil it down to what needs to be there. And actually, I spend a lot of time and often several full starts in the beginning because it's almost like a jazz riff or something. If you can start it right, then the rest of it tends to flow. But getting that start is really important.
What stands out in your mind as a column that you've written that has actually influenced either the debate or the policy and legislation?
Oh, I think certainly in the last few years, there was a piece I wrote in 2010 called Myths of Austerity, mm-hmm. which I think provided I was taking on this growing consensus that deficits were the thing and to focus on. Among other things, that's the column where I introduced the character of the confidence fairy.
Right.
Who is one of my great contributions, I think, to the imagery of economics. That was interesting because you think, what does it take to write a column like that? You have to know macroeconomics. Mm-hmm. You also have to be current on what's going on, what's on the trends. You have to be sensitive. You realize what people are talking about and sensitive to the policies. And so this was in the moment. And yet I think that's a column that people will be able to look at 20 years from now and still read with some sense of appreciation because I was getting at something important there.
Do you ever get phone calls from political allies or adversaries?
Well,
either calling up an adversary saying, hey, we usually disagree, but I agree with you, or allies saying, Paul, what the hell are you doing to us here?
Yeah, it happens sometimes. I've been given a little bit of grief sometimes. I mean, I think my relationship with the Obama people is not entirely a love fest because mm-hmm. I'm often, I'm in the position of supporting their goals, but often being pretty critical of what I think of as their falling short. And
you supported single payer for national health.
Oh, I would always
Medicare and
well, no,
that,
but
that seemed to have zero traction in the White House.
Well, and I understand. No, that was an interesting thing. I really wanted the public option, but when it wasn't forthcoming, I still was a big supporter of the program that as opposed to nothing at all.
So you like RomneyCare? You think that's a good solution?
No, I think it's a solution.
Better than nothing.
Better than nothing. Can be improved at some date to be determined. But no, but it's actually interesting. I had I have just recently out this big review of Piketty on inequality, and I've been getting some calls and emails from moderate conservatives saying, well, I don't like much of what you write up, but I thought that was a really good piece. So I guess somehow or other I managed to be informative.
And your wife has described the reaction to some of the early columns as frightening, you've become a lightning rod. And I've actually described you as pissing people off because you're right, not because you're partisan and polarizing. I don't know if everybody agrees with that. And we could talk a little bit about Krugtron the Invincible, your forecasting record, which I find kind of amusing.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly true. I think the amount of animus I get, I do get.
That's just, I'm really just, by the way, I'm just dropping papers so you can ignore the distracting
noise.
That's
all right. We do, yeah.
And this is your Nobel piece I have, and this was really a fascinating piece in The New Yorker. But let's get back to that before I so rudely interrupted you. The lightning rod aspect of the column.
Yeah. I think I appear to occupy a space in particularly in the right wing mind that is surprisingly large and not very loving. And I get amazing amounts of mail that you is not really very nice.
Are you still moderating your own comments?
Mostly not. If we find it's just too much, and we've got
good
mostly.
Had that conversation, and I said it was a waste of your time.
Yeah. Well, someone has to do it. I think it is important
that's what
you have a form.
Are for.
Yeah. So we've got that mostly being done. Actually, well, just an aside, the big problem on the comments is I have had what were almost certainly paid trolls, and we banned them. The other problem you have actually is that people who are not political, they just want to use the comment space to tell their life story, telling you what they had for dinner. And that requires a lot of editing to get those out. But anyway.
Trolls. Talk about paid trolls a sec. I did a piece here. Mackenzie Funk wrote a book called Windfall, which was how money was being deployed to invest in climate change. And we're not talking about socialist, left-wing Frenchies. We're talking about UBS and Deutsche Bank and Goldman putting money to work where they think it's going to be treated best. And 2,000 comments in 24 hours, clearly not – most of the pieces get 50, 100 comments. Clearly over the top. Who are paying trolls to go out and comment?
Well, I think it's probably we know that some of this happens, right? We've actually had situations where corporations have hired people to put positive or negative comments out on the web.
Astroturfing.
It doesn't take much here. I think we could very easily have some local. Or maybe not local, for all I know, some
Russian, Indian, Belarus. You get some.
Oh, actually, I have a colleague at Princeton who's constitutional lawyer. I'm working on Central European and Hungarian issues, and I occasionally have let her put up a post on my blog, and then we get an onrush of comments which are clearly coming from paid trolls working for the ruling party in Hungary, right? So,
and they're that concerned about what the comment thread, the Guardian did a study and found not only do most people not comment, the numbers are just overwhelming. It's a tiny fraction of 1%. Most people don't even read the comments.
Yeah. But on the other hand, it's cheap, I suspect. I mean, we have had some clearly identifiable trolls over the years. Often, actually, what was clearly one guy posting under five or six different names, but the style was identical.
Right. And the IP address comes up relatively similar, if not identical.
Yeah. And my guess is that probably some, for all I know, some high school student in his parents' basement, who's getting a few dollars from the RNC or something like that. So it could be, it's not an expensive business, but it's interesting. But anyway, you get these, clearly, well, for a while, National Review was paying this guy to attack me in blog posts, and he was actually putting up more blog posts attacking what I wrote than I was putting up blog posts, and articles actually saying anything. So, I think the answer is that as opposed to some, just plain someone saying things they don't like, I know Katrina Van, who probably, they clearly don't like what she has to say, but I don't think she gets anywhere near the amount of hostility, because I'm not just saying that you're wrong, but I'm saying, here, let me show why you are wrong, and actually let me explain why your argument is stupid.
Here's the math. Yeah. Here's the facts, don't like the outcome, so...
Yeah, that gets people really upset.
So now let's talk about the shift from Princeton to CUNY, and what's a day in the life of Paul Krugman going to look like next year?
Yeah, actually, sort of year after next, because it's I'm giving Princeton a final year of teaching. But
and you actually are a working professor. You have classes, you give out syllabus, you put it on your blog.
Yeah,
I mean, you teach a number of classes a semester.
Yeah, it's I mean, to be honest, it's a lighter teaching load than people at community colleges get. And for the past couple of years, I've actually been buying back half my time at Princeton. So I've been on a half schedule and a half salary.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the thing about the move to CUNY is that I'm at a point in my life when I'm not really as committed to theory seminars, mm-hmm. latest in the literature, as once I was, which is not at all saying that there isn't great stuff going on there, but when you're in your 60s, it's not quite the same as even Paul Samuelson really wasn't doing a lot of new theory after he was 50 years old. So mm-hmm. there comes a point at which you say, okay, is this really the center of what I'm interested in right now? Very interested in these issues involving income distribution. I've worked with and know the people at Luxembourg Income Study, which is actually run in large part from CUNY, which is mm-hmm. kind of odd, but there it is. Also the personal things. I'm New York suburban kid.
Right.
At some level, I always thought that if grown up intellectuals did was they ended up living in New York. And at
you
this
went
point,
to
why
school,
not?
High school in Belmore, is that right?
Yeah.
On Long Island?
Yep.
So from Belmore to Connecticut to Massachusetts and then back to New York. You know, one of the funny things about the CUNY program, when I was preparing for this conversation, people are attacking you studying inequality and getting paid a reasonable salary. I'm like, really? That's what you got? It's public what CUNY's paying for you, and I'm guessing that that's a salary cut from what Princeton...
It's complicated because I was on half-time at Princeton.
But I mean, the equivalent is effectively...
I'm certainly not. Yeah, it's even stupid to deal with it. But you know,
they attempt
to claim that I'm somehow, you know, extracting a vast salary for nothing. First of all, it's not. You know, it's good, and I believe that people who make the kind of money I'm paying should pay pretty high taxes. And
you are.
Oh, I am. The idea that I'm going to do nothing. Oh boy. So actually, this is where you get to a day in the life, right?
Right.
So what are my days?
What time do you get up in the morning?
I usually am up by 6 or 6:30.
So you
I'm an
sleep
early
late.
Riser.
Okay. Yeah.
It doesn't seem to matter how late I go to bed. I just don't manage to sleep late.
By the way, I don't use an alarm clock. You strike me as a guy who just rolls out of bed at the same time every day.
Mostly I do. If I have if it's crucial that I not oversleep, it almost never happens, but I will set an alarm just in case. But I don't actually, I usually wake up out of sheer adrenaline or something.
Right. Time to get up.
Time to get up. These days, I'm in my 60s trying to take care. I usually get up and go for a run either outside or on the treadmill, do my 3 miles in the morning, have my 2 cups of coffee and my, these days, alarmingly healthy breakfast, and then sit down at the computer. Or actually, often now stand up at the computer. Again, I'm doing all these stuff, you know, that they're telling you to. So I work on and off at a standing desk, and
write for a couple hours.
Write well, surf for check read my news sources, my analysis sources.
What are those sources? How do you like? I have a series of tabs in a folder, and I get up in the morning and I open all those tabs.
Yeah. So I look look at the Times. First thing, I'm big on reading the Times on a tablet, which I can do over breakfast. Then I'll look. I like FT Alphaville.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous, great.
Fabulous, great stuff.
Blog post from the FT.
I'll look at Economist View, Mark Thoma's blog, which is a great sort of compendium of interesting economic papers every day. So.
I tell people when people say to me, why do I want to read a blog? Hey, you can get a really smart guy to go out and do all this work for you and say, this is what's important, this is what you should see, and it costs you precisely zero. How can you say no to that?
That's right.
And yet some people just don't wrap their head around that.
Yeah. And then we'll It may be.
You're right on the Wall Street Journal editorial page, I'm sure, in your top three, right?
Right. Well, no, it's if somebody directs me to something particularly stupid there, I'll go and read it. But then I'll be following some links. But then I'll sit down and often put out a few blog posts in the morning because
And those are a quick hit, not a multi.
Or sometimes they're bigger, but the blog is in part. You know, I'm doing a lot of exploratory thinking,
right.
Analysis, even a fair bit of
thinking out
analysis.
Loud in public.
That's right. And then it will often be grist for the column, but not always. Sometimes it's just a thought. But so actually, what I will be doing, I expect I'll be doing in New York, is I'll probably make a point of going to the office just about every day, just because the whole point of the CUNY thing is to be able to interact with the people there, and also that it's going to be a really nice commute, mostly walking, a little bit of subway and a little bit of walking to get there from my New York residence. So it'll be a nice rhythm to the day.
Do you ever throw up a blog post and actually get some insightful direction, link, comments from readers where say, oh, this is usually helpful?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes the comments are in there, but particularly, and now lots of people correspond with me. So I'll write something I'll write something about European economic developments, and I'll get an email from Kevin O'Rourke in Dublin telling me I should look at this or that, or I'll get an email from Barry Eichengreen at Berkeley, who's a real expert on this stuff, saying you should know about this. Now I'm getting lots of feedback, and it's actually one of those things, one of those really good things turns out from doing the blogging, because I'm obliged in the Times to weigh in on lots of things where I am certainly not. That's not my core field. I'm not a healthcare economist. I just play one on TV, right? And so trying stuff out on the blog, and then often getting feedback from people who really are experts in that subfield is a really good way to get informed.
It absolutely is, and I don't have the same reach that you do, but I get insight and links. When I was working on the book, I wrote that in public, and I can't begin to tell you. Each time I'd throw up 500 words that would eventually become a 2,000-word chapter, how many sources, things that you didn't know about? Hey, Berkeley has this PDF based on an interview with this guy. Have you seen this? No,
right.
Why the hell would I have ever seen that? That's fascinating. And it's amazing how generous and helpful a smart readership can be.
Yeah, it's a great I mean, it's a funny thing. We're living in a miserable age for economic policy. We're living in a great age for economic discussion. The quality of the back and forth on all the issues that I'm interested in is really amazing. I know a little bit of the history of these things. I know about the debates between Keynes and Olin over post-World War I policy, or the famous debates of history. And they were not a patch on what's going on now, where we have these really high quality discussions going on in real time, where you have first rate economists going back and forth on each other's ideas, you know, almost on a day by day basis because of the technology makes it possible. So this is a great era for learning about stuff.
Right. It's not a dry academic research paper that a handful of people get to see. It's out in public.
Yeah, and you're not waiting 18 months for something to get through the refereeing process and show up in a journal, and then another 18 months for the reply to do the same thing. Here, you can have a whole quite intense discussion play out over 2 weeks.
So you mentioned earlier one of the bloggers you're a fan of.
Mark Thoma.
Mark Thoma. What other economic bloggers are you a fan of?
Well, Brad DeLong at Berkeley.
One of the first economic bloggers he's read a decade ago.
These days, well, I mentioned talking about economists, Mia Nasufi. They now have a blog, new one, House of Debt, which is really good.
Oh, I've seen that. I've seen a few posts from them.
They're new on the scene. Big fan of the Irish Economy, which is various people, Kevin O'Rourke and others in Ireland. Simon Wren Lewis at Oxford has a blog called Mainly Macro, which is
I've seen
really
that.
Good stuff.
Sure.
I have to admit, I do look at Business Insider, which mm-hmm. is this. It's kind of Huffington Post like. There's a lot of how to comb your hair and tie your tie mixed in with some pretty acute analyses by Joe Wiesenthal and so on.
Mm-hmm. Joe's a good guy.
Yeah. And
Noah Smith, I know you've
Noah Smith is a young guy who really probably should be getting out his papers instead of blogging, but he's doing great stuff on blogging. It's fun.
He's back and forth to Japan every summer. He spends 2 or 3 months there. And speaks fluent Japanese with an undergraduate degree in physics. He's one of these really interesting characters and is quite prolific. I thought I wrote a lot. He really cranks it out. Yeah. And interesting stuff.
Yeah. I think my career advice to him would probably be to
publish,
but it's a great resource for the rest of us. I'm sure that I'm missing people. That's the problem you always have here. But there's just so much stuff going on now, but there are a few people like Noah or Brad or me and Asufi, just in the last really month that I've been reading them, and it's just a great resource.
So we're in an era of terrible economic policy. But great economic discussion and debate.
That's right. Fantastic for, as an economist, having time of my life. As a citizen of the world, I'm aghast. What can you do?
Professor Paul Krugman, thank you so much for coming by and spending so much time with us.
Okay.
And we really appreciate it.
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.